Good afternoon, everyone. We're so very grateful that you've been able to come out to Sunstone this year and that you've decided to join today's panel entitled Worth of All Persons. This is the part where I ask, plead for everyone to silence that cell phone. As you will remember and have been told yesterday and today, we record these sessions. And I'm sure you've already heard the spiel about going up and talking to the wonderful volunteers who are working at the tables to pay for the recordings that we make here of all the sessions. And even though you're sitting in the session, it's always good to, you know, buy it so that you can listen to it over and over and, you know, check your notes. And so I bring that up also because when we get to the Q&A portion, if you do not wait for me to come to you with the microphone, it will be a loss for the people who have purchased this session. They won't be able to hear your question. So please be patient as we work through this, the Q&A section. And with that, I'm going to turn the panel over to Carla Long, who is absolutely amazing, and the yin to my yang.
It's true. Sorry. Got all excited. Hi, I'm Carla Long. I'm a bishop with Community of Christ, and I had this idea for this panel, and Robin Linkhart helped me put the panel together, this motley crew right here. So in Community of Christ, one of our core values, which we call our enduring principles, is called the worth of all persons. And we believe deeply that everybody has worth. And when I read the theme for Sunstone, the least of these, I started wondering how other faith denominations look at that idea, the worth of all persons, or look at the least of these. And so I was really curious to talk to someone from the LDS Church and someone from other faith traditions that I don't really know that much about. So really, this session's all for me. I hope you guys get something out of it, but I'm really excited to hear about what Dan has to say. This is Dan and Nancy and Ruth and Lachlan, and they're going to introduce themselves, and they're going to talk about what the worth of all persons, or the least of these, means in their faith tradition, and then we're going to open it up for questions, okay? So while they're talking, start thinking about some questions that you have in your mind to ask them, because they're only going to speak for 5 to 7 minutes each, and Mary is very serious about that, and then we want to hear from you and ask all your questions, okay? So I'm going to turn the microphone over to Nancy. She's going first.
Okay, is it, nope. That sounded bad. Okay, is this working? No. Is this? Okay, we're good. Okay, so my name is Nancy Ross, and my perspective is that I used to be LDS and then recently transitioned to Community of Christ. And so when I was LDS, I had lots of different callings in primary to teach children for most of my adult life. And whether I was teaching 3-year-olds or 10-year-olds, I would eventually get to a lesson titled something like Jesus Loves Me or Jesus Loves Everyone. We probably had both of those lessons. And I felt that this was the most important lesson on any Sunday, and not just the one specified by the manual and the curriculum. And the manual would generally cover examples from the Gospels where Jesus healed, comforted, and blessed individuals at the margins of his community. And I liked the easy simplicity of those lessons, and I felt that they were lessons that spoke to my heart and that children could easily understand. And then during singing time, we sang songs like, with lyrics like, Jesus said, love everyone, treat them kindly too. But in adult classes, though, I do not remember having those lessons. I do remember lots of discussion about the kinds of behaviors or identities that might chase away God's spirit. And though black men were ordained and black women allowed in the temple several years before I was born, I heard throughout my life that black people had made choices in the pre-mortal life that impacted the way that they were treated in this life. And the anxiety as I experienced as I heard too many homophobic comments in November and December of 2015 was a catalyst for me having to leave. And I know that many faithful LDS would say that we can love the sinner and hate the sin, and that love does not equal acceptance.
And I have to say that I've never seen anyone talk about loving the sinner and hating the sin go on to actually demonstrate love for those that we talk about as sinning. And the love expressed in those statements was more abstract than concrete. And it was clear during all those conversations that there were firm boundaries around who was deemed worthy and part of God's team and who was not. But it was always hard for me to separate worth and worthiness. And the more I heard worthiness discussed and debated, the more I doubted my own worth. But today, in my religious life as a member of Community of Christ, I do not experience the tension between the simple message of God's love on the one hand and the way in which God measures worth on the other. I do see the many ways in which the members of my congregation are keen to affirm the worth of others. During the weekend of the No Ban, No Wall protests, we held our church service in the park and invited the public. And during that service, Chelsea quoted Ezekiel 47:22 and reminded the 50 people there that God commanded the Israelites to ensure that the children of the stranger had an inheritance among the children of Israel. And Jeremy, suggested that we support Native American water protectors at the Sacred Stone Camp and then followed through with organizing donations. And Melody, who is straight, patiently educated extended family members on LGBT issues, while Victoria modeled love and acceptance of her gay brother in the hopes that her family would follow suit. Christina worked tirelessly to support LGBT students and students of color at my university, and Emily saw that Muslims were not represented on the local interfaith council and set us on a path of getting to know the group, inviting them into the broader faith discussions of our community. The question was no longer, or is no longer for me, who is on God's team and who isn't, but rather how do we affirm the value and dignity of all of God's people? And it's easier to connect with and grow my own feelings of worth in a congregation where people demonstrate their commitment to loving, affirming, and supporting people who are different from themselves. Thank you.
For Community of Christ, the 1960s introduction of New Mormon history began to challenge the earlier tellings of our story, and this eventually led over a period of decades to this dismantling of our own understandings of our history and our sense of being a people. We had an identity crisis. We were adrift for several decades, and during that period, we carried out the much-needed task of divorcing our history from our theology. Beginning in about 2002, members of our historical and theological communities were involved in intense discussions about identity formation, starting with the question, is the intentional creation of identity even possible? Since our historians were responsible for demythologizing or deconstructing our faith story, I believe they had a moral responsibility to help reconstruct a historically accurate and theologically sound story. Whenever we met, though, we fairly quickly ended up engaged in the process of continuing to take the story apart. The timing was clearly not right. In the intervening years, we evolved into a principle-based people versus a rule-based people and developed 9 enduring principles or core values that now define not necessarily who we are yet, but who we strive to be. And one of those principles is the worth of all persons. I continued to believe through the years that intentional identity formation was possible. And in a conversation with Jim Mulholland, then a Quaker minister from Indiana, he shared some important insights into how to make it happen. He argued you needed just 3 things: song, visuals or art, and story, the sharing of personal or communal experiences. The song component is now in place, as illustrated by our new hymnal, which includes songs like For Everyone Born, A Place at the Table, which is joining the Spirit of God as an unofficial anthem in the church. We are making great strides on the visuals with icons based on the work of John Hamer representing our enduring principles released just last week. Also in the last week or so, John has released a graphic illustrating our 8 sacraments or ordinances. And this is in addition to the countless illustrations he's shared with us through the years. So the third of the 3 elements, story, is my focus as director of our historic sites and lead of our church history team in Community of Christ. So a quick example of one of the ways that we're using story. Now, we're still doing academic history, but that's not what this is about. So a quick story. Joseph Smith III, oldest surviving son of Joseph and Emma Smith, is elected Justice of the Peace in 1857 Nauvoo, Illinois. He starts serving in 1858. He joins with us in 1860, and the locals are not amused. They begin passing resolutions township by township, forbidding him from preaching or praying there. In that pretty tense environment, he has to run for re-election. He wins in what he calls a landslide, 13 votes in Nauvoo politics. Here's why he won, he said. Almost everybody living in Nauvoo by that point was some kind of Germanic people, German, Austrian, Swiss. And Joseph III believed that they were being taken advantage of because of their lack of familiarity with our language and customs. So to try and protect them, he often did their legal work for free. And as a result, they turn out in mass and vote for him, despite what their religious and political leaders are telling him. So I tell that story, but I am not really talking about German immigrants, of course. I'm talking about Mexican immigrants and hoping to help our members understand the worth of all persons wherever they have immigrated from. I tell the story of Jack, a disabled African-American in Nauvoo to whom Joseph Smith Jr. gave his favorite buckskin suit, which enabled Jack to get a job. I tell the story of our struggle in 1865 in the intense politically charged climate following the Civil War as we discussed ordination of African-Americans. And Joseph III came to us with the revelation calling on us to continue that practice, ordaining African-Americans, 1865. Some of the people involved in that discussion had personal biases still. They were still prejudiced in some ways. They refused to allow their personal prejudices to stand in the way of the gospel. I talk about our story as religious and political refugees forced to flee the state of Missouri by Governor Boggs and the extermination order, but I'm really talking about the worth of Syrian refugees. I talk about Emma Smith's 1830 Harmony, Pennsylvania ordination and the ordination of her Relief Society counselors in 1842, the turning of the key to the Relief Society by Joseph Smith Jr., and the performance of healing blessings by women in the Relief Society in Nauvoo and following. But I'm really reminding our members that in Christ there is no male nor female. This one might be a stretch, and I've just started to talk about it, a stretch for our members anyway. When you read non-Latter-day Saint accounts in Nauvoo about what they didn't like about us as neighbors, almost in every case, number two or three on the list is theft. We had a problem with theft. We were impoverished. Our children were hungry, in some cases starving, and we did what it took to feed them. And I'm hoping when I tell those stories that that helps us understand the what we might consider poor decisions some of those in poverty make today. One final story that I won't tell, but involves Joseph Smith III forgiving Thomas Sharp, the man most responsible for the death of his father, forgiving Thomas Sharp and making it clear that any judgment was for the hereafter. We are called to see the worth in all, even those who have abused those we love. In the fall of 1843, John Finch, an Owenite from London, England, stayed with Joseph and Emma Smith in their Nauvoo mansion house. He described Joseph as, quote, liberal and charitable when speaking of other sects, and he said that he, Joseph, considered that the great principle of Christianity was love. Ours is a message of love, not hate. It's a message of hope, not despair. It's a message of grace, not condemnation and vilification. And I think that we can change the world one life at a time using the simple tools of song, art, and story.
Okay, I scrapped my speech, so I'm just going to ad-lib this, so bear with me. So I come from a little bit of a different history. I come from a fundamentalist perspective where I was raised in Colorado City, born in Hilldale and raised in Colorado City, and went through a lot of diverse and complex situations in that territory. And to back up a little bit, a couple weeks ago, we were having a family reunion, and my brother was speaking about my father and the example that he set for our family, and this very subject came up. So actually, it's a very passionate subject for me because I've had so many examples of what a true Christian looks like in the face of adversity and many complex situations going on. So my father was born in the LDS Church in Idaho. To parents. His father was a bishop, and he was educated at Rexburg College, finished up his education in the University of Utah, right here, and was having a crisis of faith. We all have crises of faith, and he was having a crisis of faith because he felt like he was doing a lot of research that his church was not answering for him. So he was going through a lot of soul-searching and trying to figure out where he needed to be in life. And he found himself associated with some of the people in Short Creek, which it was called Short Creek at that time. So he converted to the work of Jesus Christ, which is what we call the church, to differentiate from the Church of Jesus Christ. We call it the work of Jesus Christ, to just differentiate yourself. And ended up coming to Colorado City in 1952, just in time to fall into place with the 1953 raid in Colorado City. So he was a monogamous at that time. He had one wife and five children, but because of association and because of his coming to the area and feeling very compassionate about the people and empathizing with their cause, he was also carted off to Phoenix with the rest of the families while his wife and five children were. The men were left in Colorado City, and he was taken to, his wife and five children was taken to Phoenix. And he had to fight like the rest of the men to get their families back. It took about 2 years. And even though he wasn't a proclaimed polygamist at that point, he still had to work through the court cases to get his one wife and five children back at that time. So he, being a very outspoken person, he spoke many times in forum, public places where he was speaking for the rights of the people of Colorado City or Short Creek at that time, saying that their constitutional rights had been violated and that they were not getting due process. And eventually, the state of Utah ended up, it became a very bad political thing to have taken all those families away. So it took about 2 years for them to get their families back. Well, in the meantime, he came back to the town and for the next 30 years continued to educate, teach, was the justice of the peace for 30 years in that area, and was exemplary as far as the gospel of Jesus Christ goes. He was compassionate and empathized with the least of them. And during that time, a lot of fathers were out of town trying to earn an income, and there was a lot of children on the street, wayward children. And because he was very involved with the education and also the justice of the peace, our supper, our dinner table, often had these young children who were struggling at our dinner table, and he fed them, took care of them, fathered them, put clothes on them, and always left. They left with a lot of encouragement to do better, and that there was purpose and there was hope in their life. And it was a very complex time during that time. But so now we flash forward. He, you know, educated and worked his heart out for these people, and really, it was his community. It had become his community. It had become his heart and his soul. And he put everything he had into this. So in the early 80s, there became another crisis of faith and community where there were members of the community that were trying to change what was. Before the early 80s, there was a Council of Apostles that were the leaders of the community. And after the early 80s, the majority of the community voted in a one-man rule, a one prophet, a one leader that had sole power. And so all of you have heard stories about the Colorado City area, and we've all sat back horrified as the history has played out because of that decision. There was a few of us that did not go along with that, and thank goodness my dad, because I was 14 at the time, chose not to follow the majority of the propaganda that was being pushed at that time. And he stepped back and looked at it, and he said it was against his principles to go along with what they were promoting at that time. And so there was a few that were ostracized and shunned, and he was one of them. And for a man that had really given his all, his shirt off his back for this community, found himself very ostracized and shunned and on the outskirts of his community. So he had another crisis of faith. He had to dig deep, and he really decided that it wasn't going to affect his core values. He still loved them. He still cared for them. He still reached out for them. More and more, they became more hostile and at one point refused to talk to him altogether. But it didn't change who he was. His conviction of Christ and the restoration of the gospel did not change. And so when I say I have had exemplary examples in the face of adversity and complex, very complex culture, he's one of the number one examples that I can point out. In all of that, he was a true Christian through so much of that. He did die, I believe, brokenhearted in 1987 because he had dedicated so much to this community. And I do believe he died brokenhearted because of the change of what had happened. He knew his community had become a cult, and he was very sad, and he had warned against it multiple times. So there's a lot of changes that happened. So there was a new community that was created because of this. The few that did not go along with the majority were being evicted from their homes and had to find a new home, and we were one of them. And so Centennial Park was born out of those struggles. And we have lived in Centennial Park for the last 30 years and found ourselves in the middle of a torpedo storm with the media because Warren Jeffs and the FLDS, which they organized legally as entity FLDS after the split in the early 80s, their actions were creating a media storm, and we're all very familiar with what that was. It was in the papers. And it was sucking all of us in. And there was a lot of women from Centennial Park that this was not acceptable for us. We had really fought to stabilize our families. We had lost a lot of brothers and sisters in the split that were no longer talking to us. They had ostracized us from our homes, from their homes, from their churches, and to be lumped in the same box, it was unacceptable for us. And so in 2003, Mark Shurtleff created what he called a polygamy summit in St. George to fix the polygamy problem. And so there was a lot of us women from Centennial Park who said, this is unacceptable. They are lumping us all in the same box. We are not them, and we need to start speaking for ourselves and having a stronger voice and differentiating ourselves from other groups. And so we kind of stormed his meeting down there. They weren't expecting us. They had pretty much invited everyone but us or any polygamists to the table. And so over 100 women stormed the meeting down there, and it sent a strong message. And our message to them was, don't talk about us without us. We are people too. And that we can actually bring a lot to the table in this conversation. We've fixed a lot of our own problems since the split happened, and we can bring a lot of help to this conversation. And to Mark Shurtleff's credit and his assistant Paul Murphy, they listened to us. We walked into that meeting, and there was only two other fundamentalist polygamists sitting there, and Ann Wild was one of them. She's sitting here in our audience today. They thought they were going to fight that fight alone because this was a very large forum and a large meeting. And when we showed up, we joined the same page. We had the same cause, and that is, no, we are not all the same. We had a lot of differences, but we're not all the same, and we can come together in things that are good and leave our differences at the door. And I've really appreciated Mary Batchelor and Ann Wild and the example and the fights that they have fought for us, and it was really nice to be part of that. But out of this meeting came two things. Don't talk about us without us. We're people too. And two organizations that happened, and Centennial Park Action Committee was organized, which mostly consists of women who are determined to fight the media biases and misperceptions. And another one was Safety Net, that was organized by Mark Shurtleff and Paul Murphy to bring polygamous voices to the table and have the discussion in an open forum. And so there were very positive things that came out of that meeting, and we've seen a lot of good value that has come from that. They still remain our friends today, a lot of the people that we've met during those meetings, and we are still interacting. And so I guess my message today is, in the midst of adversity and in the midst of so many complexities. We live very challenging lives, and who knows why we're planted where we're planted. You know, I've asked that question many times. Why are we where we are? What is our purpose in life? And I think we're expected to dig deep and find out who we really are, and foremost, push Christian values forward and to have the same respect for other people and the opinions that they have. At a funeral not so long ago, one of my brothers made a statement, us fundamentalists need to learn how to play better in the same sandbox. And so that has been one of my driving themes. I'm a nurse in Southern Utah. I've worked as a nurse for 27 years, and I have always left my biases at the door. That is the professional thing to do. But among us fundamentalists, I think we are pretty harsh on ourselves. And it's been one of my themes lately is that we need to play better in the same sandbox like we expect our children to. And so I've really pushed to do more of that. Centennial Park is an open community. We do not have the walls and the issues that the FLDS have, and we do invite anyone that wants to come and see us, get a hold of us. We'll give you a tour. We remain an open community. We want it to stay open. We also want to protect our families, but we do want to keep it open where anyone is welcome to come. So if you have any questions, just let me know. And thank you.
Don't start the clock yet. Thank you, Robin. I guess this was a trade, right? You got a luxurious 18 minutes. I got a tyrannical 7. But I am grateful for this chance, though it is daunting to, in some ways, I guess.
Oh,
okay, good. And in some ways, I'm really appreciated this, and I'm going to go very fast. But I don't want you to think it's a rhetorical strategy so you miss connections of thoughts. It's just I have stories that Carla asked us to share about the worth of the souls, and these do go a long ways to saying why I'm comfortable as a Latter-day Saint, as a person from the Mormon, you know, whatever, normal mountain saints, whatever we call ourselves here. My way to Mormon, I kind of said here, would be robust. It's a word that I use on the podcast a lot to say that I find richness within it with a little look. So now for my 7-minute blitz here. I'm a theology nerd, but you don't want theology for 7 minutes. So here it is in 90 seconds. Here's what I love. All things are eternal. All things are uncreated. This implies that they have intrinsic value. This is explicitly shared in certain scriptures about the worth of souls. It is rooted in scripture and Joseph Smith's notions from Nauvoo and echoed in temple theology that everything is capable of enlargement, that God's goal in all things, including non-sentient beings, is to for them to experience joy in the measure of their creation in whatever sphere they are in. All things are thought in some ways as persons with their own ends, even non-sentient life. Earth has a spirit capable of responding, mourning, and we assume rejoicing. I've written a doctoral dissertation that speaks to all of these and many more. I love still how the concept of Zion animates the Latter-day Saint Church today, and I have caught glimpses of it through my church experiences. First, let's stop with Paul in Corinthians 12, starting at verse 21. The eye cannot say, then from the New International Version, I like the language a bit better from King James. The eye cannot say to the hand, I don't need you, and the head cannot say to the feet, I don't need you. On the contrary, those parts of the body that seem to be weaker are indispensable. And the parts that we think are less honorable, we treat with special honor. And the parts that are unpresentable are treated with special and the parts that are unpresentable are treated with special modesty, while our presentable parts need no special treatment. But God has put the whole body together, giving greater honor to the parts that lacked it, so that there should be no division in the body, but that its parts should have equal concern for each other. If one part suffers, every part suffers with it. If one part is honored, every part rejoices with it. I lived in many wards who welcome, rally around, and in many ways make central in its community and its spiritual life people such as these that I will mention. On my mission to Washington State, Edward, with a huge head and neck tumor, he was a beloved greeter at every sacrament meeting. in a California ward, Paul with cerebral palsy, who was also a greeter and bore every single month the most fervent testimony I've ever heard, though perhaps we could only understand about 20% of his words. In my two Tooele wards that I've lived in, Nathan is a high-functioning autistic young man who bears testimony far more eloquent and heartfelt than most adults, and yet he was under 10 years old. But when stresses overwhelmed him, he'd light fires, sometimes endangering his and other families. But he and his family were embraced. Brittany, in that same ward, is a mid-teen, also high-functioning on the autism spectrum, a testimony each month that generally included some rebuke to the rest of us for something that we weren't doing that was not Christian enough. Brent and Dan are two twin boys who were adopted as infants from a mother who was a severe alcoholic. They were hellions whose minds didn't fully track and whose energy knew no bounds. I was in a ward who extended callings to various men throughout their growing years to be their companion and caretaker during primary, allowing them to be part of their classes as much as they could. Their family was always welcomed, always supported. In that ward, Nard, Lori and I taught 10-year-olds in primary for several years, and now we regularly return as these 10-year-olds go to and from missions and become married. And what is the thrill it is to have Dan and Brent pass us the sacrament. In our ward in Bountiful, Utah, Andrew, a severe Down syndrome and multiple physical issues. He's nonverbal with words, though not with sound and with great volume and at unexpected and normally not appropriate times. He was rallied around. I loved his friend and neighbor as he would for many years hold the hymn books and walk with Andrew as he would hand each of us one before priesthood opening exercises. After we changed building, the situation left that task unnecessary, and Andrew was then called to be the Sunday school bell ringer. At 10 minutes before the end of class, we'd get 2, 3, sometimes 4 rings, varying lengths and things like this, depending on Andrew's mood or depending on how much control the person from the presidency could exert. Again, we'd get the same lovely thing before the end of the class. Andrew was noted during ward conference sustainings as a special secretary in the Sunday school presidency. When he passed away a few months ago, and he was in his early 20s, there was not a dry eye in the packed building for his funeral as, following the reading of his obituary, we sat quietly as the Sunday school president presented 2 wonderful long rings of the bell. My mother, Beverly, was by many standards one of the least. Though she was brilliant, one of the brightest minds I've ever encountered. And she, more than anything else, wanted to serve, wanted to give. She wanted to share favorite stories and insights. She was very theatrical. But for many reasons, she had, over the final couple decades of her life, been unable to do this skillfully. Mental illness, debilitating periods of sadness and regret, led her to weigh about 400 pounds and have many of its attendant hygiene issues and a home that she could not keep well. Yet at church, she was welcomed and honored by many. By bishops and home teachers and handfuls of others, she was beloved. They caught a glimpse of who she was and what she had to offer, even as she could not always be seen by those who were put off by outward appearance or her occasional bull in a china shop way of forcing their awareness of her stories and other gifts. These are, many of us will recognize, counted by most as being among the least. But sometimes so am I, the least. I'm the known egghead, the Democrat. I'm known to be not mechanical at all. Living in Davis County, Utah, I cannot lift the hood of my car in my driveway without a neighbor noticing and being by my side within a minute. One time I was blessed to become aware and just to notice that 3 of the men on my street had magically appeared. Even if my hood is up just to change the oil, somehow just the right tools appear from their well-stocked sheds. My battery posts also get scrubbed and other things cleaned, noticed and cleaned. A retired brother from my ward, Leon, spent 3 hours with me tearing apart and cleaning sprinkler valves and troubleshooting heads. In our long conversations during the work, I mentioned something about a television show. Without the least bit of guile, he shared with me that he hadn't watched television in more than 20 years. As there were always neighbors to visit and people who could use a hand. Our high priest group quite often spends many minutes as we gather, sharing reports on the lives and the health and the needs of the many widows and single women with families that members of our group home teach and serve in many other ways each month. Mechanically, handy-wise, I am the least of these. I can think circles around most of them. I can teach and share scripture and insights from my many adventures in the worlds of philosophy and religious studies. I can preach sermons with my mouth, but none of these are as eloquent as the sermons those around me preach through their hands and their feet through their service.
Thank you, panel. Thank you, Dan and Nancy, Ruth and Lachlan. I hope that you were listening carefully. And I hope that you have some questions for our panel. And if you do, Mary will come along with the mic, and please ask into the microphone.
This is the part when we decide which of these microphones is going to help us do this the best. I think this one. Not necessarily OSHA, but yeah. Okay. Yes, sir.
In a earlier session, a woman was talking, the session was dealing with LGBTQ issues, and this woman said, "Don't talk to me about toleration. I don't want to be tolerated. I want to be accepted." And my question for each of the panelists is that an unreasonable request? Yes or no? And if it is not an unreasonable request, how are you or your faith tradition approaching the subject in connection with the worth of each soul?
No. So one of the ways that I approach that, I was not long ago, one of our reunions, we do their family camps. We went from having general conferences twice a year to once a year in the 1880s. We were worried about missing out on the fellowship of gathering together. So we do these family camps for a week on campgrounds around the world. I was in one of these camps in the Florida Panhandle, which is really South Alabama, and talking about LGBTQ questions has been challenging in that culture. And so I spent a lot of time talking to them about the civil rights movement of the 1960s. And were they leading, or were they following, or did they go with the flow? And how did they think about that now? And in most cases, they were right there with the flow, and they regretted it. And so, again, what I was really talking about was not the civil rights movement, and most of them got that. So that's one of the ways I've approached it.
I would say that because I've lived an alternate lifestyle, polygamy is an alternate lifestyle, not the traditional lifestyle, in the different organizations that I've worked with, there's been LGBT members among them that we have befriended, and they've befriended us, and we've become extremely good friends. There is a mutual respect, I think, among us. We're just waiting for the P to end on the end of that.
In my congregation in St. George, we were largely formed over the issue of the November exclusion policy, and so we absolutely don't think that tolerance is enough, but inclusion is central to what we do and how we talk about the congregation's goals, including being involved in organizing an interfaith service for the St. George Pride in September. So we're very much involved in issues of inclusion and advocacy in our community.
This is tough because I'm representing Mountain Mormonism here, more than saints. Acceptance is not quite near as we'd want to. I think tolerance has arrived, a weak virtue for sure, but definitely it's there. But before acceptance, I mentioned that as I was sharing that little bit about my mother, it was her being seen past the, you know, however you'd want to put it. And I think that's what we're missing within our tradition. You know, this policy was to say, let's not have children of gay parents be seen, to be normalized, to do those things. And I am grateful for John from the panel this last hour. I'm grateful for all those who are mama dragons, and I see affirmation fighters here who are saying, I am with you, I'm in your community. You know, in theory, you can have that theology. In theory, you knew that, but guess what? This is my child. Boyd Peterson mentioned it yesterday. He goes, it's fine to talk about separating the sheep from the goats, but my family's all left the church. So what are you saying about my family as you do these theoretical things? And so within Mormonism, this, you know, I don't even know what to call it. Should I just call this LDS versus, I don't know. You guys.
I like Mountain Mormonism. I think Mountain Mormonism.
Okay. In Mountain Mormonism, we still just need to be seen more and stories more. So I hope with John and others and Maxine, who, if we can stay, please stay to be seen, and then maybe that would be the gateway to acceptance.
Next question.
I have been nothing but inspired by stories I hear, you know, within ward communities, whether it's whatever religion or even like any church congregation of any religion, just within the administering and being like Christ and being his eyes and hands. And it's just so inspiring. And all of you inspired me today. But I am not knowing much about Community of Christ Church as far as its similarities or differences with like visiting teaching home. I'm just curious because I've loved all the stories of Community of Christ I've ever heard. I just am inspired by the religion. So I was just wondering if what kind of administering, like, is it just like if you feel the Spirit or is there like an organization? I just am curious more than anything.
Or does it vary, you know, depending on where you live?
Yeah, I'm not sure I fully understand the question.
So I think if I'm getting it, what sort of ministering opportunities are there within your church community? Auxiliaries and etc. Yeah.
We don't have to call people to love each other. Oh.
So I think that most of it would be folks on their own participating. We have some who would do priesthood visits into homes, and we love each other's company generally. And did I talk about 8 sacraments? Some would say potluck is our 9th sacrament. Table fellowship, whether it's in homes or in restaurants, or we spend a lot of time together, but it's probably not a formal, that's probably what Nancy was saying, probably not a formal calling.
And I'd like to add to that another question of my own, which is that a lot of times, and many of us are here at Sunstone believe this and thrive in this, is the finding a new community. And a lot of times, I mean, Lindsay and the crew do a great job saying, here's for the newcomers if it's your first year. So I think it would be interesting for each of you to sort of add, what is your intention when you see somebody new coming into church or the table ministry, as you said?
So my first intention would be to make them feel welcome. In Community of Christ, we don't know what the word proselytize means. It's just not part of our vocabulary. But we do want to be invitational. And we do want to help people find healing and wholeness in their lives if they're coming from a broken place. And so We welcome people to journey with us, and some enjoy our company and stay, and some might find wholeness in their lives and move on, and I think that's success. helping somebody, we would call it the peace of Jesus Christ. If somebody has found the peace of Jesus Christ in their lives, whether they're part of our community or not, if they've achieved that, that's success.
Yours would be an interesting answer first.
So I've had quite a lot of experience with this. I'm very sensitive to the new face in the community, and being part of an organization that tries to help anyone that wants to come through with a tour or into our home, I'm very involved with that. And I've just taken in so many people, but I'll talk about a couple scenarios. One was a FLDS girl that had been kicked out of her home because she picked up a movie from a red box and watched it, and had been living in her car for a couple of days before my daughter, who was taking a paramedic class with her, realized it. I said, "You bring her home. Do not allow her to sleep in her car one more night." And so she brought her home and remained in our home for the next year. She became our daughter, and of course, every one of these people are so beautiful. But we walked her through that year of transition for her and through her marriage, and we were the ones standing in the audience when she got married. And so she's one that I would consider. She came, she passed through, then she moved on to other things. And we have a lot of experiences like that too. But to hold people in a holding place while they are transitioning or going through whatever things they are going through in their life is a very important thing to do. Another family, mom and dad, alcoholism, drugs, grew up in the area but had abandoned family values, pretty much abandoned these four children. We brought them into our home and have spent the last 10 to 14 years raising them in our home. And they're not staying. One of them is baptized, and they're going to church, but the other ones are moving on to college and other things, and that's okay. It's okay. It's very important for us to pick people up where they are, give them a place, a safe place to be, a warm bed, warm food, and hold them in that space until they need to move on to in their journey in life. And so I could go on and on. There's a lot of examples here, but it's a very important subject.
Intention was your, what is, yeah. I'm sure it's slightly different in non-Jello Belt Mormonism. If anyone shows up, it's, wow, another person to add to our community, to fold in and things like that. I'm sure within the Jello Belt, Utah, Idaho, you know, Arizona, if they're in the apartments, sometimes it's like, oh, yeah, we'll get to know them a little bit here and there, and it's sad that that's not the case. I don't think that within my particular ward or things like that, anybody has any intention but other than full friendship and fellowship and things like that. When it comes to the intentionality of myself and my wife is very, very good at finding anybody that she doesn't know and saying something to them. I'm a fairly frequent flyer in fast and testimony meeting, you know, 4 or 5 times a year you'll find me up there for some reason. My intention is to always signal, you know, through not necessarily always explicit language, that everyone is a worth and everyone's there. And I have had wards where I sometimes go with the explicit purpose of making that child who I expect is LGBT to know that they're cared for and loved for. And I know that that is a thing that I'm not alone in. So it's hard to speak for everybody, but I think we're growing in those areas.
Our congregation is very small, and so we just try to get to know people and welcome people through relationship. And our very small congregation is really built on strength of relationship. And so that whoever walks through the door, we're interested in getting to know them, and it's through getting to know them that we can love them and make and hopefully that they can feel welcome.
As someone who's developed, who's mountain saint, a little bit what I call a post-correlated mountain saint, but who, starting with last year's end of Sunstone devotional, became acquainted with Community of Christ and developed a great respect and affection with the Community of Christ, I also want you to know that Christianity can be practiced in the traditional LDS church. Right now I live in San Antonio. I am staying over with my daughter while I'm here, and she has adopted a young man from the Belgian Congo who is going to school here now and had visa problems and bought him a plane ticket to go to Washington, D.C. to get his visa straightened out, where he also stayed with a daughter I have. I have seven daughters all over the country, so you know, you can go about any place and run into one of my daughters. And he's stayed with her while he's in D.C. getting his visa straightened out. He came back. He let this young Belgium Congo person contribute to my grandson's missionary fund, but she will not allow him to buy groceries. So Christianity is practiced, perhaps because of, or perhaps in spite of, or perhaps some of both within the LDS Mountain Church.
Yes, sir.
So I have a question. I appreciate all the faith traditions. They're fascinating. So Stephen R. Covey in his book says, you know, you should begin with the end in mind. I have a theoretical question for each faith tradition. If Joseph and Emma were here, what would be the... If you would say, my faith tradition's goal is blank, what's the end goal of your faith tradition? What would that be, and how would you communicate that to the founders?
What would my end faith goal be? My goal is to align myself as much with the original founders of the restoration as possible. So I read a lot of the first four prophets and the history and try to align myself with those values and principles as much as I can. That's why fundamental polygamy is still very much a part of my life. When my dad converted from the church to the fundamentalism, it wasn't necessarily about polygamy, but he just felt... like the polygamists have been very mistreated, and he was on a quest to find out why that was and ended up joining in the process. Now, he lived many years amongst them as a monogamist, and then one day there was one of these monsoon storms that we have in the Hilldale cities that has caused a lot of these floods that you've heard about, the families that died a couple years ago. My mother's family was camping up in the canyon. My father lived a mile away. His wife, who was also a nurse, his first wife, was away working, which they had to do to travel out of town for jobs. And he realized the storm had hit the canyon, and this family was up there camping. Well, he left his family and knew he needed to go check on this family to make sure they were okay. He found five young daughters and their parents drenched to the bone and really cold. So he gathered them up, brought them home, fed them supper, gave them a warm bed, gave them dry clothes. And out of that, the oldest of the five daughters became his second wife. Now, why did it take a monsoon storm in July to bring my mom and dad together? I don't know. I don't know why I was born where I was born. I've asked that question a lot of times. But I do go back to the founding fathers of the church and want to affiliate myself with them as much as possible, because that principle was well and alive during that time.
I'm going to be influenced a bit by Terrell and Fiona Givens in some recent conversations, and I think addressing this. But I think it'll fit nicely, because I think all the traditions at least have a knowledge of something called the New and Everlasting Covenant. And the take that the Givens are beginning to present, and that sat well and does sit well with me, is that God's eternal purpose and glory was to take these uncreated spirits and to weave them into one great family, to teach them about each other, to truly unite everyone as brothers and sisters, no matter what. So within Mormonism, Mountain Mormonism, if we were to be talking to Joseph and Emma, we would certainly point to the value of genealogy, of temple work, and things like that. We can also call upon Dieter Uchtdorf a few years ago, talking about, are you sleeping through the restoration? Are you sleeping through this? How can you be participating in it? And he begins to use the language of the covenant. And one of the ways of honoring that covenant and actually working in this restoration and within this idea of the whole covenant community of every single being that ever, you know, came within God's sphere is to see them, it's to honor them, it's to meet them. It's so that they can feel love and the shackles and the blinders that life throws upon them that tells them that they're not divine, that they're not eternal, that those can be thrown off. And so I love the idea of uniting us all, and I see it alive within Mormonism, if maybe not quite as explicitly articulated as I hope it will soon. Soon be. Do you want to try any luck?
So I think the end goal is the cause of Zion, the peaceable kingdom of God on earth with no poor and no war and compassion and justice for all.
We have time for one more question. Who's it going to be?
You get a car. You get a car.
Oh, sorry.
I'm a big scouter. I mean, I'm in the scouts. You were talking about organizations. Do you affiliate with the scouts? Community of Christ, or FLDS.
Yeah, in Community of Christ, we are involved in scouting. I was not a scout myself, so I might not get this detail right, but I think we had the first scout troop west of the Mississippi. Is that accurate? And just signed in the last month or so, an agreement with scouting to continue that relationship.
Dan, can you go into a little bit more about how you feel maybe about the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints' current decision regarding scouts?
You are welcome, sir.
It's actually, interestingly, I was surprised that we did a podcast, you know, when they changed it, and it's like triple the normal downloads. So there were lots of people who aren't normally in the discussions that my podcast covers that had, you know, they wanted to process that news. So for those who don't know, they've from ages 14 up, they're canceling it by the end of the year, the varsity and the Explorer Scouting, and they're keeping it from Cub Scouts up through age 14. They're encouraging any scouts that are in the track already to go ahead and be supported. But basically, because Boy Scouts of America and Scouts of Canada are really the only scouting organizations, throughout the rest of the world they have four principles, physical, intellectual, I can't remember, and then like 50 or 60, you know, options for doing it. So basically, from what I understand, is the church is saying, let's make what is alive in the rest of Mormonism, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saint Mormonism, alive here. I feel it's a great thing. I actually enjoyed my time as a Cub Master, you know, during the time. I was actually called later, but it was after the LGBT denial there, and I told them I can't get certified by the Boy Scouts of America with that stance. And as much as I would have loved working with those kids, and I did enjoy it, and we had great pack meetings and all that good stuff, that was a hard choice for me to say no to that calling. But I look at primary presidents, and I see them jumping for joy and all those different things, and I think it's fine that it fades away. So my personal take.
It becomes more universal, more international.
Yeah, and whether they'll get rid of it eventually, or this is the steps now. But.
So I want to give Carla the last word.
I just really want to say thank you so much to the panel. Weren't they wonderful? It's not an easy thing to come up here and speak at Sunstone, I don't think. So I'm really appreciative. Thank you so much for coming. Thank you so much for saying yes. And I would be remiss if I didn't invite you to church on Sunday at Community of Christ. Actually, Lachlan is teaching Sunday school. Nancy is preaching, and I'm presiding. So if you want to see any of us again, then you... that was not the plan. Lachlan is teaching Sunday school over Community of Christ and the Word of Wisdom. If you're interested in that, Nancy is preaching. So it's going to be a great communion service, and we're going to have lunch afterwards. So if you just want to come for food, that's fine with us, too. That's what us Community Christers do. So the most handsome guy in the room, this guy in the Project Zion shirt, is going to hand these out at the... go ahead and give him a hug. He's a great hugger. And thank you so much for coming. Hey, Kuz, just go stand at the door.
And don't forget, they also have a booth out in the concourse there. So any further questions that you might have, Carla's hanging out forever. And the rest of the panel are all very approachable. Thank you for coming.